dangerous, what's been deemed dangerous fireworks by some, basically fireworks that fly up into the air and explode. They overturned that law. Councilman Flood believes that the city should now adopt those laws as a precaution, particularly when it comes to fireworks like firecrackers or bottle rockets, things like that. So she has introduced this ordinance. It was heard in the Public Safety Committee. I don't think it moved anywhere as far as the Public Safety Committee was concerned. But there are those who have said in criticism that the law will essentially just force people to do what they already do, is just go across state lines or go to other counties and buy those fireworks.
Any opposition or anybody else speaking out about this ordinance in the council?
Well, Councilman James Peden, the chairman of the Public Safety Committee, he has shown some concern, voiced some concern, saying that there's the issue of enforcement. I asked Councilwoman Flood about that. She was saying that the only reason that Councilman Flood has a problem with the ordinance is because he likes to shoot fireworks.
Okay, well, we'll leave that one alone.
Yeah.
So this one is still in committee, and it will come up at some point down the road.
Likely.
In the full council. Likely. Also, Councilman Dan Johnson had some legislation as well. Tell us about that. The war on workers, he calls it.
Yeah. Historically speaking, when you talk about metro government, the resolutions, these non-binding measures, don't really carry any teeth with them whatsoever, unless there are unanimous decisions altogether where the council speaks as one voice, all 26 members vote in favor of it. These resolutions oftentimes can be very partisan and sort of silly. There have been some that have supported the war in Iraq, supported, you know, measures that the Metro Council has no jurisdiction over whatsoever. The most infamous one, I think, being the Saggy Pants resolution that Councilman Green introduced a few years ago. The one that Councilman Johnson has recently introduced is called the War on Workers resolution. It basically just outlines that the councilman objects to some of the action that has been taken against public employees, particularly in Wisconsin and Ohio, saying that Metro government does not favor and does not see that as a value they support. It has a co-sponsor, Councilman Rick Blackwell. There's no telling if this resolution will be debated or will catch any sort of flack in the council, but it could just be tabled or put on the consent calendar where a lot of these resolutions go and they're voted on as a pile instead of individually.
Okay, and one final item for you, Philip. We found out that Louisville is losing some federal counterterrorism funds. Tell us
about
that.
One of those sort of those under-the-radar stories. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced a round of cuts, $170 million in total, to about 30 mid-sized cities as a result of budget constraints, according to Congressman Peter King from New York. Essentially, Louisville will lose, set to lose, $2.2 million in counterterrorism funding that it received last year, and has really received since 2008. Last year, when then-Mayor Jerry Abramson and Congressman Yarmouth announced the $2.2 million, it went to things like MetroSafe as far as securing money for radio infrastructure, satellites, things like that. I mean, it's the satellites, radio waves, and I think coordinating between city personnel, city emergency first responders, and county first responders. So that way, a lot of people sell it as ensuring the public safety, but the Department of Homeland Security says that the priority really should be in these more major metropolitan areas. Critics have slammed this as sort of reckless behavior on the department's part, and lawmakers have promised that they will reinstitute the funding as soon as possible.
All right, Gabe, let's move on with some education news that you've been covering this week, and the search for a new Jefferson County Public Schools superintendent is moving forward.
Yeah, earlier this week, the Board of Education interviewed some candidates for an interim superintendent. This is something that members of the board, several members of the board, have said they would like to avoid, is having someone who's going to serve in between current Superintendent Sheldon Berman, whose contract expires at the end of next month, and whoever they end up choosing in this search. They haven't appointed anyone, and Chair Steve Imhoff says they won't appoint anyone unless it becomes necessary, unless they haven't made a decision on a new superintendent by the end of June, or if they make a decision and that person has things to wrap up wherever else they're working and won't be able to start until sometime after July 1st. Now, that decision on choosing someone is moving along, and the schedule for that has been revised. The deadline was Tuesday for applicants to send in their resumes and throw their hats into the ring for this job. On Saturday, the board will meet in the morning to start looking at these resumes, looking at these applications. They'll have a list of semifinalists later in that week, and then they'll conduct some interviews, and they'll announce the finalists on June 1st. And from there, they'll meet with the stakeholder groups, they'll meet with various people, and the interview process will continue.
And you may have mentioned this, there are 28 candidates for the job?
Yes. And the names, I don't know. A few people have come forward and said, yes, they've applied for those jobs. That list of finalists, though, with the specific names, who they are, what they've been doing, that will come out on June 1st.
And there are some people within the school system that are applying for it.
Yeah, a few local people in the administration right now for Jefferson County Public Schools have expressed an interest in what would essentially be a promotion then.
And just to review, Dr. Sheldon Berman, the current superintendent, his contract was not renewed back in November, and he's on his way to another job.
Right? Yeah, he is headed to Oregon. He started looking around for jobs at various cities that were looking for superintendents for their school district shortly after the board decided not to renew his vote or not to renew his contract. And so he's headed to Oregon.
And you also reported this week that the Noah's Ark themed amusement park is moving forward.
Yes, the controversial Ark Encounter Park. The State Tourism Commission, Tourism Administration, has approved $40 million in what amounts to tax incentives, tax breaks for this park if it's built, if it ends up bringing in the tourists that they're expecting it to bring in.
And on one final topic, we've been very mindful since the Japan earthquake and tsunami about the possibility of an earthquake here in this region with the New Madrid Fault, and MetroSafe folks have been taking part in a drill this week.
Yeah, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is mandated by the federal government to conduct these national level exercises, they're called, every year, these widespread tests of private agencies, of state agencies, of city agencies to respond to a major disaster. This year it was an earthquake simulation on the New Madrid Fault Line, which is in western Kentucky. So the severe earthquake that they simulated this week would have done damage. You would probably actually feel it in Louisville, but the damage would have been done in western Kentucky, Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, that area, and just kind of shake out there. But the big problem, or the likely response for Louisville, would be to send emergency workers to western Kentucky, because Louisville has more resources than a lot of the cities out there. So on Wednesday, FEMA activated this drill, and the MetroSafe crews were all kind of they were activated. They got the first responders together, got them ready to go to western Kentucky. It was a test of those MetroSafe radio systems that have been purchased with some of these counterterrorism dollars. It was a test of just the readiness in general of first responders in Louisville. Lexington also participated in it.
So this was quite a big operation.
Yeah, it was pretty significant. It's the one big one that they do every year, and this one was to see, you know, what would happen if there were a major earthquake in the United States. The New Madrid Fault Line seems to be where that next major earthquake will be.
All right. Well, Dalton Maine, we haven't forgotten about you, and you've managed to stay awake through our first 20 minutes or so.
Barely.
But you of course, have been working hard this week. You were busy with the election on Tuesday night, but you also managed to cover a development involving the Gray Street Farmers Market. What's going on there?
They have just been approved and picked up the Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which is a program administered by the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. It's basically it's similar to food stamps, and it's for low-income seniors who, you know, might have limited access to fresh fruits and vegetables, but it's a way to get them aid in purchasing these. And it's currently run at, I believe, six other farmers markets in the city of Louisville. And Gray Street picked up the EBT, you know, food stamps last summer, and this is a new addition for this summer. And the market manager, Melissa Schreck, said they're very excited about it. They said it's a good way to build the community. So,
and the Gray Street Farmers Market is occurs how often, do you know?
It'll start, I believe, May 19th. So I believe it started yesterday, and it'll go until August or September. So,
all right. Mm-hmm. And I have one question for the rest of you. Do you know exactly what time the world is supposed to end tomorrow?
It's 6 o'clock local time. Oh. It follows time zones, I believe.
I have my ticket. Do you?
I was wondering whether or not to get a bet down on the Preakness.
But I'm in row 4,300,062.
Okay, well, I'll see you in line tomorrow.
There you go.
Okay, thanks, guys, for joining us. Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, and Dalton May from the WFPL Newsroom. And we'll be back. Joining us will be Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Last week, Kentucky Attorney General Jack Conway accused Marathon Petroleum of gasoline price gouging during a state of emergency, filing a motion to that effect in the Franklin Circuit Court. Now, the two sides were in court yesterday for a very long hearing on the matter. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh sat through it, and he joins us now to talk about it. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to hear from you again. Well, the emergency that Attorney General Conway refers to is the declaration made by the governor in response to flooding, correct?
That's right, and he declared that on April 26th. and it remains in effect, and I'm hearing that he likely will re-up it because we're still there's still residual cleanup and that sort of thing, so he may re-up it for another month. And the issue here is whether Marathon Petroleum illegally jacked up its gas prices, which would be a violation of the price gouging statute that's part of the state of emergency. And, of course, the Attorney General says they did, and Marathon Petroleum says they did not.
What is Marathon's defense? They were saying this is just a natural increase?
Well, we had a hearing yesterday, like you say. I think Marathon is an appropriate title here because it was a marathon hearing, and it started at 9 o'clock in the morning in Franklin Circuit Court and ended about 4:30. And the first half of the hearing, we heard from an economic expert for the Attorney General, and the second half of the day, we heard from an economic expert for Marathon Oil. And, of course, they both had contrary opinions. And the AG says that during the state of emergency, you cannot raise the price of gasoline unless it's starting to cost you more. And their expert, or the AG's expert, said that he did not see anything in the price of crude that would indicate that there were that could support 20, 30, 40 cent hikes in the price of gasoline, which were reflected at the pumps at Marathon and Speedway gas stations during some of the time of this state of emergency. So they argue that that the price hikes were not justified based on the price of crude. Marathon, on the other hand, their expert came in and said, and he had some interesting charts and graphs, and of course it's an oil company, it was very well presented, and it was interesting to see the graph showed that prices of oil had risen steadily until about the time that the governor declared the emergency, and then there were these wild fluctuations, and the price went, the spot market in Chicago, which is the commodities market, there were wild fluctuations in the price of oil or crude, and so they argued that we had to compete. We can't just keep a flat line on our prices. We have to go up and down, and therefore we had to raise our prices, but we also lowered them. So they argue that the AG is not being fair because if you just set an arbitrary price, I think it was $3.25. Was the price of the of oil or gasoline at the wholesale level on April 25th, the day before the emergency went into place? They say you can't just hold it at $3.25 throughout the whole emergency because then we can't be competitive. So it really comes down on how you view it. There's so many factors that go into how gas is priced, and it's going to be up to the judge now to decide.
Well, what is Conway asking for the judge to determine or to do with this case?
Well, he wants him basically to say, since the wholesale price of gas was $3.25 on April 25th, he says that Marathon should be held to that level throughout the emergency declaration period. Marathon, again, like I say, argues that you can't do that. That's price setting or putting a cap on it, and we can't be competitive if you do that. So Judge Thomas Wingate, who's the Franklin Circuit judge, he has to weigh all this evidence now, this voluminous evidence. I mean, it was a lot of testimony, obviously. And he said it'll probably take him at least 5 days to get through all of it. But the AG wants him to, give injunctive relief, requiring Marathon to roll back the prices to the price they were before the state of emergency. So as to whether that will actually occur, I don't know. I think that Marathon would have a good argument on the judicial branch limiting their ability to compete. So I don't know. We'll see.
And the price of gas seems to be going down now, so they could actually
raise
it.
Marathon's economic expert argued that. He said, they cut – the AG's expert looked at it up to this point, but in the last 8 days, gas prices have gone down. So if you averaged it out, it's not like we've gouged consumers, really. It hasn't – between the highs and the lows, it's kind of averaged out. So.
And Attorney General Conway's gone after Marathon before, hasn't he, on something similar?
Yeah, this is really just he kind of has amended a previous lawsuit back in 2005 when we had Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. I think it wasn't for about a year or so later they decided that they would sue Marathon over the same thing, price gouging during a disaster. And so that case has been going on for four years or so. and it still is in the court. So you can see how these things can really stretch out in the judicial system. But this is really kind of an addendum to that. But the accusation is pretty much the same, price gouging during a disaster or a state of emergency.
And earlier this week, you had a soundbite with a Marathon attorney who questioned the timing of this the day before the election.
Well, yeah, I think that was a little bit of a stretch, though, because Jack Conway, the attorney general, he's running for re-election, but he didn't have any primary opposition. And so they were bashing him as if this was a political thing, but he didn't. And it was the day before the primary when they made that statement. But again, he had no primary opposition, so I don't think he was trying to benefit himself in the primary.
Is there a timetable for the judge to rule on this?
Well, he there's no specific timetable. He just said it'd probably take him a few days. So we figure, I think we'll probably get something next week.
Okay. Let's talk about the election a little bit. Of course, you were front and center in Frankfurt on Tuesday night. You attended the big Democratic Unity rally. Is the party unified heading into the fall campaign?
Well, as I reported from the rally that night, it might have been the Unity rally, but there were two glaring omissions. Allison Lundergan Grimes was not there. She was having her party in Lexington. And Elaine Walker, who is the appointed Secretary of State, appointed by Governor Beshear, was not there. She was with her friends in Bowling Green. So obviously there's a little bit of a split there. The governor appointed Elaine Walker, and Lundergan Grimes is the daughter of Jerry Lundergan. And there's some bad blood between those two guys, Lundergan and Beshear. Lundergan ran against Beshear a couple of times back when Beshear was in the legislature. Beshear beat him both times. And so there's no love lost between these two men, and now Lundergan's daughter is running for Secretary of State, and she grabbed the nomination, the Democratic nomination, Tuesday night, and she faces it looks like Bill Johnson in the fall, but I guess we may be going to talk about that too. It looks like there's going to be a challenge in that race. But obviously there is somewhat of a division in the Democratic Party between the Beshear camp and the Lundergan camp.
Jerry Lundergan, of course, the former Democratic Party chief here in Kentucky.
That's right, and he also has served in the Kentucky House. So, and he's also a caterer in Lexington, Kentucky, and has catered events at the White House. So he's well known.
All right. Well, let's talk about Hilda Legg and Bill Johnson. That race was very tight. This is the Republican race for Secretary of State. Johnson winning by, I'm not sure how many votes it was, but she is asking now for a re-canvass.
Yeah, Legg won by just over 1,100 votes. It was a really, really close race. She ran against Bill Johnson. He's the Tea Party favorite from Elkton. Hilda Legg is a former federal administrator from Somerset. And like we say, the race ended just 1,100 votes, or just a little over 1,100 votes apart. And so Legg, I mean, you would expect this. Legg is asking for a re-canvass, and I just went by the Secretary of State's office before we got on the phone here. And Hilda Legg has now sent a letter to the Secretary of State officially requesting a re-canvass, and that will occur next Thursday morning. And basically county clerks will just go through and recheck the vote tallies on the machines, recheck the absentee ballots, and check their math and make sure no human errors were made, and see if that vote tally stands. Bill Johnson says that's fine with him. He's going to need Hilda Legg supporters in the fall if he's going to take on Lundergan Grimes. And so we'll have the re-canvass. They'll check the numbers. And it likely, I've been in Frankfurt a long time, and I don't recall re-canvass ever overturning an election. So, but it is a legitimate request on the part of Hilda Legg, and we'll see what the results are.
Not unusual, and a re-canvass is not the same as a recount. This is a more general count instead of actually counting every vote again.
That's right. Like I say, you just go back and recheck the numbers, make sure nobody made any human errors or math errors, and check the tallies on the machines. Now, a recount, that involves recounting every vote. You have to get a judge to order it. It can be very, very expensive, and the candidate that requests it has to pay for it. So we don't get too many recounts.
No, it brings back memories of hanging chads down in Florida.
There you go. We don't have too many of those.
We don't have to worry about those here anyway. Well, you went to the Unity rally Tuesday evening in Frankfurt, and there is a Republican, your Unity rally guy, there's a Republican rally tomorrow you're going to attend.
That's right. The Republicans always hold their Unity rally on the Saturday after the primary, and so they're holding one tomorrow. And I'm sure our listeners all remember last year's Unity Rally, and that was a big one because Rand Paul snagged the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate over then-Secretary of State Trey Grayson, which was a huge, huge upset, and that was quite a Unity Rally. I covered that one, too. This one won't be that big, but, you know, it'll be all the Republicans will be there and holding hands and cheering and kumbaya and having a good time and getting fired up for the fall campaign. And, of course, David Williams, the Senate president, he'll be at the top of the ticket, and he'll probably lead off. Actually, I haven't confirmed exactly if Senator McConnell and Senator Paul will be there, but if they are, they'll top it off, and then they'll get to the candidates, David Williams on down. I'm sure it'll be a big time.
And Governor Beshear, you reported today, is throwing some cold water on this, saying he has lots of Republican supporters heading into the campaign.
Yeah, I said in my story he's a party pooper. The governor has put out a list today that shows that he has at least 70 prominent Republicans in his camp, including John Akerson from right there in your town. He's former GOP chair, a Louisville Metro councilman, and I remember John Akerson when he was in the Kentucky House. The list also includes the mayors of Lebanon, Harrodsburg, Bardwell, and Versailles. Steve Pence, I'm sure everybody's heard that name, former lieutenant governor. And I just went through the list and picked out a few names. And the one that jumped out at me was Michael Scanlon. He's a big restaurateur over in Lexington. So the governor's saying, I've got at least 70 of your people, you Republicans over there who are on my team. And the governor says he's going to put out another list later on, so we'll see who's on that list.
I've asked others this but is there any quiet time between the primary and the general election to give voters kind of a chance to get all this out of their minds for a while, or are we going to head right in, hit the ground running?
I think we're going to hit the ground running. The governor, on the day after the primary, was right back out there handing out money and being gubernatorial, you know, traveling all over western Kentucky and acting like a governor. And his wife, the First Lady, Jane Beshear, was running around doing First Lady things, and they're not wasting any time hitting the ground. And then the Republicans, of course, are going to have their big Unity Rally, and I'm sure David Williams and Richie Farmer will be getting on the bus and traveling around. So there won't be a lot of downtime. And, you know, Kentuckians love politics, and they especially love governor's races. So I'm looking for a big time and a lot of fun here in the months ahead. And, of course, Rick, as you know, Fancy Farm comes up on the first Saturday of August. So we're headed right toward that.
Well, we know who the top speakers will be for that.
Well, that'll be the gubernatorial candidates, of course.
And a light turnout last Tuesday, and very few complaints of voter fraud?
Yeah, only about 10%, a little over 10%, which was right on the mark of what Elaine Walker, the Secretary of State, had predicted. It's kind of disappointing. You know, there are people dying over in these Mideast countries for the right to vote, and people here in America just won't even get out and vote. So kind of disappointing. Hopefully we will do better in the general election this fall with the governor's race on the ticket. That should pump up the turnout somewhat. And when you don't have many people coming to the polls and not too many major races, we had the gubernatorial primaries, but there was not a lot of election fraud. I think there was only 6 or so calls to the election fraud hotline. So that actually is a good thing, you know.
All right. Well, Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh attending the Unity Rally tomorrow night. In where is it going to be? In Frankfort?
It's at the GOP headquarters in Frankfort. Actually, it's at noon tomorrow. So,
oh, okay.
It'll be a big time at the GOP headquarters.
We'll listen for your reports and for your coverage of the campaign and the Kentucky General Assembly. And as always, thanks for joining us, Tony.
Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh, and we'll be back with more of State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and we now turn our attention to Southern Indiana. Joining us are Shea Van Hoy and Daniel Suddeth from the News and Tribune. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a while since we've talked with you. We've got a lot to go over. Let's start with the Jeffersonville Canal, Shea. More details about the $65 million project unveiled this week.
Yeah, they had a meeting on Tuesday night where some details were released. Not really anything new as far as the components, but where they would be and what they would look like, sketches and photos and things like that. And one of the main things that came out of it was the announcement of three parks, and it's going to be sort of linear. One on the north end of the canal up near 8th Street, then a central canal that would cross Court Avenue, and one on the south side of the canal near the river.
And this project would be used for flood alleviation, but also as an economic development tool.
Yeah, the flooding aspect is kind of secondary to the combined sewer overflow problems that not only Jeffersonville has, but Louisville and New Albany. And that's the main thing is getting rid of the untreated sewage that washes into the Ohio River, which can lead to fines, has led to fines. Flooding is secondary, kind of taking care of that. And then also the economic development aspect, which that's what this meeting kind of shine more light on, convention center, entertainment district around the convention center, and the parks that would go along with it, with possibilities like a skating rink and obviously outdoor activities for families and things like that.
Is this ready to move forward? Everything in place now?
Yeah, we're moving forward. The city's moving forward with it. We're looking at a construction schedule, some pump work beginning late this year, and if it does, continue to move forward, you would see actual canal construction and bridges over the canal in late 2012.
And $65 million, pretty firm on the price?
That's for the canal aspect.
Right.
So the actual conveyance system to the river, the landscaping, the bridges, kind of busy work for the convention center. And then the total cost they're looking at is in the $140 million range for other pump stations and kind of lift stations to help with this sewer overflow problem in different parts of the city, including up at the ammunition plant.
All right. We mentioned flood alleviation. Southern Indiana, of course, had its more than its share of it over the past month. There's been, I believe this week, Governor Daniels had an emergency declaration that includes most of the bottom third of Indiana.
Yeah, Clark and Floyd counties, Daniel might be able to talk a little bit more about New Albany because they saw more in the way of damages than Jeffersonville did.
Yeah, there was quite a few damages to roads and infrastructure, streets. A lot of Mayor Doug England and his administration is claiming. Of course, we had the huge floods in August of 2009 that much of the damage carried over from when the state was unsuccessful in being declared an emergency area at the time and didn't get any federal funds, though Louisville actually got federal funding and federal relief at the time. And obviously, we were hit by the same storm as Louisville, and there was actually an actively passed in Congress not far after that of basically if you run next to a county that's declared emergency area, even though it's
separated by a state, that's
it can still receive the same federal aid as, such a metropolitan area like Louisville that's divided by a state line there. But yes, road in particular, Spring Street, Hill Road, they're estimating about around $1 million, I believe, in damage there. The road washed out in August of 2009 after it had been previously closed for about 6 years due to erosion issues there as well. So they're claiming there's some carryover effects there. I believe $2.1 million in damage just in the city from this last series of storms they're reporting.
I think the total for the both, we had a story this week, total for both counties is $3.5 million in damages and kind of overtime related cost. In Clark County, it was, a lot of things that people are used to, like in Utica, which sits right on the river. They've been through it before. They move their stuff out. Then it's just coming in and cleaning up again.
This disaster declaration, part of the process of getting qualified for federal funds. And I talked to a guy from the Department of Homeland Security the other day. He said in order to the threshold is like $8 million just for infrastructure and roads and whatnot that were damaged. And he says that thus far the tally is like up to $36 million. So as far as that goes, you're qualified.
And it's separated, of course, into public and private.
Right.
Private was nowhere near, I think, this last storm able to get the threshold for homeowners to be able to declare for emergency relief.
Well, we haven't talked to you guys since the May 3rd Indiana primary. This year it was limited to municipal elections. But there were some interesting developments in Floyd and Clark counties. Let's start in New Albany, Daniel. A new face among the Democrats for mayor.
Jeff Gahan won the primary. He's currently the city council president, served on the council for two terms, and actually gave up a chance to run for the seat again to pursue the chance to be mayor. Of course, there's yet to be a Republican candidate named that he will be running against, in the November runoff. But basically, it was very interesting in the fact that his primary contender, Irv Stumler, raised quite a bit more money than he did as far as fundraising. I believe Irv Stumler raised more than $40,000, and Jeff Gahan raised about $7,800, and he was still Stumler was endorsed by current mayor Doug England and still fell about 350 votes short in the primary. Very low turnout in the primary is typically the case, I think, in Kentucky, as you were talking about earlier, had low turnout in their state primary as well. So very interesting there. Only incumbent councilman who ran for re-election who lost in the primary was Steve Price. Jack Messer was another incumbent, but he did not seek re-election, so he didn't have a chance to run.
So Gahan is the Democrat for mayor. Now, there was no Republican on the ballot, but they say they're still going to try to field a candidate?
They have until June 30th to appoint, and how that works, since they didn't meet the filing deadline to declare a candidate during the filing season, they could not officially name a candidate until after the primary had concluded, and now they have until June 30th. Our papers talked to local Republican leadership several occasions, and they promised us that they have a candidate. There's been quite a few rumors about who that may be, possibly trying to get a few local state officials to be interested in it, which has pretty much been denied on the record to this point. So I guess we're kind of waiting to see. And actually, what was unique about the primary, there's not a single Republican challenged primary. So basically, all the primaries were for Democratic seats May 3rd, which some people would say it's an advantage for the Republicans who were seeking an election, didn't have to spend any money. But some people say it's the Republican leadership said it's also kind of can work against them because they're not able to get their message out as much as they feel they would be able to if they were campaigning earlier in the election season instead of having to wait for the fall race.
Now, Doug England, the current mayor, he is seeking a seat now in the city council, right?
Right. It's a confusing thing. He first came out and said he was going to run again last year. Then earlier this year, I believe it was in January, announced that he would not. He served two terms in the 90s and then was reelected and served in this beginning in 2008 and said that he was not, in fact, going to seek another term and endorsed Irv Stumler at the time, and then later announced that he was going to seek in a council at large position. And he was one of the top three. He was actually the top vote getter in the primary. So now himself and two other Democratic candidates will face off against three Republican candidates, and the top three there will advance and win a seat for 4 years on the council at large.
And Shea, in Jeffersonville, in the mayoral race, Tom Galligan versus Mike Moore.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Many times in the paper we've reported those two gentlemen, making comments about each other, sometimes not so favorable. Tom Galligan is the third term, non-consecutive term mayor, and he seeking a fourth term. This would be his. He served from 96 to 2003, and this would be another eight years in a row if he would get four more. He easily won his primary. Honest, just my personal opinion, a little closer than or a little not as close as I thought it would be. It's pretty much a runaway, and he had three other candidates, including a former mayor. And a county councilman running against him, but he moved on easily. Mike Moore was unopposed as a Republican, and so it's going to set up to be a really interesting race. And there are many aspects to that. Mike Moore is a Democrat county councilman. That's how he won his seat, but he's running for mayor as a Republican. So there's that. That's going to play into probably some of the political advertising and the talk beforehand is the switching of parties.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Mike Moore is a very visible county councilman, county commissioner, which is the executive branch of county government in Indiana. And so on a local level, two high profile people running for the seat.
Jeffersonville is now a second-class city in terms of population. Yep. It's a first-class city otherwise, of course. But, but that means some extra seats on the council this year.
Yeah, the council will go from seven people. It's currently seven people until the end of the year, and then we'll go to nine. So like New Albany, it'll be a second-class city, and we'll have three more council seats, two more council seats, one district and two at-large that are added. And so that added some interest to the races, and I can't say there are probably any big surprises in the race, but one interesting thing that people have been talking about is Matt Owen, who's a 20-year-old college student, initially declared for mayor on the Republican side, and then he decided to run for council at large, and he was the leading vote getter in the primary. It's kind of, I think, helped him to get his name out there when he declared, and he's done also a really good job of campaigning, I think.
He has. I talked to him the next morning. He's a Republican, a young Republican, and says he's just tired of the yeah. lack of communication, he said, was this big issue between, you know, politicians and the citizens.
Yeah, he, you know, when he was at, in school at JHS, he went to council meetings, taped him. So he's very aware, probably way more aware than a lot of people his age at the process.
He said, hey, so that's what got him hooked on politics, covering when I remember covering my first council meetings and stuff in another town. I thought, well, no, I'll never do this. So.
That's, yeah, me too. I don't
but that's, that was good for him, though. Yeah. And also, I don't want to pass up Charlestown Mayor Bob Hall running for re-election against Donna Ennis.
Yeah. Don Ennis is kind of a political newcomer. Bob Hall has isn't the incumbent mayor, Republican. Donna Ennis is. Has been involved in Charlestown a lot with various things, veterans events and things like that. So she's pretty visible, someone a lot of people know in town. And Bob Hall easily won his primary, also kind of a little bit a wider margin than I would have thought. He was running against a city councilman named Mark Goodlett. You know, we'll see how that plays out. That right before the election, an audit came out about Charlestown, and there were some issues, as audits usually find, because that's what auditors are supposed to do, and didn't seem to affect the primary race, but we'll see how it goes as we move to November.
And in Clarksville, there's been a request for a recount on one of the races?
Yeah, Clerk Treasurer Gary Hall, who narrowly lost, I think it was like 25 votes, to Bob Lightheart, who is a businessman in Clarksville, but that was the only recount we had, was Gary Hall, who's the incumbent clerk treasurer, and his name's been in the news quite a bit lately, more than a clerk treasurer normally would, because of a Clarksville audit. Not that he was cited in the audit, but just that he basically was the one of the people, the person that took the information to the State Board of Accounts and said there's something, you know, there's something odd going on here. At least that's what we've have, you know, have him on the record as saying. And he's asked for a recount against Bob Lightheart, whose father was involved in politics and in Clark County. And like it was, I think it was 24, 25 votes.
Let's talk about that Clarksville audit. Is that still ongoing?
Yeah, we have the audit came out last month. It was released. It was kind of a two-tiered audit. The first part was just a general town of Clarksville audit, which the State Board of Accounts in Indiana does with regularity. Usually they take a two-year span, and then the audit will come out. For this case, it was 2007 to 2009. But if they find something that they think warrants extra attention, they'll go back and look at it. And in this case, it was the street department and spending and oversight. And they found things like excessive costs. One of the things that stood out to us and we reported on, among many things, was a remanufactured car engine that was purchased with taxpayer dollars, mm-hmm. but then just sort of vanished. There was a radiator that was purchased for a vehicle that the town didn't have, tires that didn't fit vehicles they had. So where we're at now is the audit gets turned over to the Clark County prosecutor, Steve Stewart, and also the attorney general's office for a couple reasons. The prosecutor is the only person, the local prosecutor, that can bring charges. He has not said either way. For the latest article, we didn't he didn't return our calls asking for comment on what he planned to do. And you know, probably would just say he was working on the case anyway. The attorney general we did talk to, attorney general's office, I should say, and they said that they could recoup costs for people, but they can't take any criminal action. But some of the money's already been paid back by a street department employee named Donnie Hansford, who paid back about $1,500. So the attorney general is looking at that as repayment and saying right now there's really no money to go after. So it's kind of we're just waiting to hear from the prosecutor on what might happen.
Let's move over back over to New Albany, Daniel, and you wrote recently about the Linden Meadows development. And this, tell us, give us a little history lesson about this. And there's a rejuvenation effort underway.
Right. Linden Meadows was basically a housing development that spawned from the expansion of Floyd Memorial Hospital and Health Services a few years ago. The group was formed, Community Development Housing Organization, to move about 16 houses over to a subdivision named Linden Meadows, and this idea was endorsed by the state. The city didn't really have much of a role funding it, but did provide some land to it. There was a long history here, but basically it was not an idea welcomed by the neighborhood. These houses were intended for low to moderate income first-time home buyers. The area used to be a community park. There was a lawsuit filed against the Community Housing Development Organization when these houses were moved to try to attempt to keep it from happening. Eventually, the lawsuit was settled. The houses remained. They slowly fell into worse condition as there was issues with basically, it depends on who you listen to. The side that was charged with organizing this said that the lawsuit held them up. By the time the lawsuit was cleared, the housing market fell through. Financing for low to moderate first-time homebuyers is probably not, you know, the easiest thing to attain in the first place. And, you know, this didn't help the fact that the housing market became what it did. This project was endorsed. The Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman was on hand a couple of times to endorse it during various ribbon cuttings. And when the state released money and put into this organization, well, long story short, eventually the housing organization had a pretty sizable loan from PNC Bank that they defaulted on. The state had poured money into this and was basically the lead agency on it, came in, observed the work, had some problems with the conditions of the houses and just the terrible structure that they were in, condition they were in structurally, and then ordered work to be stopped. This was 2009. The bank would not really allow anybody to come in to work on this until they received payment for what they were owed. They had a settlement in mind. It was rumored to be about $500,000, and the state was only offering about $300,000, as was reported. Eventually, a new developer was selected by the state to try to come in and save this, but they couldn't work out a deal with the bank for more than a year until this past week, when the side said they had agreed on a financial buyout to obtain that land. A new private developer is going to come in, basically have ownership of the land. The state's going to pour another $1 million into this project to basically allow them to pay off this bank note, to be able to have some money to refurbish these houses. These houses are in deplorable condition. A couple of weeks ago, two city employees were arrested for stealing copper out of one of the houses, allegedly. It's just been a big eyesore.
Just looking at the pictures here.
Right. It's just been a horrible situation. While the city voted recently to put some money into about $30,000 in community development block grants into the project to purchase two lots, basically a lot of the councilmen are saying this is it. If this doesn't work, we're going to bulldoze all the houses and start over. Some of these houses will be torn down, talking to the developer to make way for new ones. Some of the same concerns still exist from a lot of elected officials. The housing market has not really improved that much. Some people don't know if it ever really will improve to what it was before, and you're still talking about most of these houses will be geared toward low to moderate income homeowners. There will be more of a mix than the original plan, but there's also still some concern whether it happened. But the developer basically gave the city his word he will be working on improving those houses within about 5 weeks.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're out of time. Shay Van Hoy, Daniel Suddeth from the News and Enterprise, News and Tribune. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
And thanks for listening.